You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today is Rodney Smola. He's the president of Furman University and the former dean of law schools at Washington and Lee and at the University of Richmond. He has written numerous books, including most recently Deliberate Intent and Jerry Falwell versus Larry Flint, The First Amendment on Trial. He's here today to talk about his newest book, The Constitution Goes to College. Please welcome Rodney Smola.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. The premise of this book, The Constitution Goes to College, is that American universities, both public and private, have had their identity largely shaped by constitutional values. So here at the University of Minnesota, it's easy to imagine that because it's a state university. And so students here and faculty members here have constitutional rights that they can assert against the University of Minnesota because the University of Minnesota is an arm of the state. It may seem harder for you to imagine that it's true, however, at a private university because the private university is not an arm of the state, and therefore you might think that constitutional law issues don't bind private universities in the same way that they do publics, and that private universities have not been shaped by constitutional values. It turns out, though, that my intuitions are that it doesn't really matter whether you're at Duke or the University of North Carolina, 10 miles away. The Duke professors act as if they have the same rights that the North Carolina professors do. And the Duke students act as if they have the same rights that the UNC students do. But more significantly, the universities act as if they are obligated to treat the Duke professors with certain rights, such as freedom of speech, even though technically, legally, they have no freedom of speech in relation to Duke because Duke's a private entity, or due process, or to abide by norms of equal protection in the way that they administer their admissions policies or otherwise engage in the university. So this book is a mediation on why that's true, why it is that constitutional values have so seeped into the consciousness of higher education that both public universities and private universities act consistently as if they're bound by them. One of the early things I explore is the concept of academic freedom. Academic freedom is almost the holy grail on American universities, and it is something that is litigated from time to time. And one of the things that I look at is some of the classic questions, like, is academic freedom an entitlement that individuals have, or is it something possessed by institutions? It's been a debate in scholarly literature and among the courts for many years as to whether the notion of academic freedom resides in people or resides in entities. It turns out that it may depend, technically, on whether you are a state university or private university. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that comparison because it illuminates a larger part of what I was talking about in the book. A private university as an entity possesses free speech rights, for example, First Amendment rights, in relation to the larger governments that might attempt to regulate that university. So the University of Notre Dame has academic freedom rights that might give it the power to resist certain regulations by the state of Indiana or by the United States government. It has freedom of religion rights as an entity, and it has other First Amendment rights as an entity. A state university like the University of Minnesota arguably can't possibly have legally enforceable academic freedom rights in the way that a private university here in Minnesota would. The reason for that is that it's almost incoherent. It's almost nonsensical to act as if the University of Minnesota has a constitutional right that it can assert against the state of Minnesota, because the University of Minnesota is the state of Minnesota. It is an extension. It's an appendage. It's like the hand asserting some right against the brain. You can figure out for yourself which of the two would be the hand and which would be the brain. But the idea that a state university possesses academic freedom rights vis-a-vis the creator that brought it into existence doesn't seem to make sense. I've already talked to you about how, at the individual level, individual students have arguably academic freedom rights vis-a-vis the entity, the university, but it wouldn't exist at the private side. So this question as to whether academic freedom resides in individuals or in institutions seems to, there's a sort of asymmetry to it. If it's a public university, the university has no academic freedom, but arguably the people there do. If it's a private university, the people have no academic freedom, but the university itself arguably does. But of course, in our culture, we act as if both have academic freedom in both situations. We sort of borrow. So the private university treats the people on the campus much as if they were at a state university, typically. And the reverse is also true. Often courts treat state universities as if they have academic freedom rights, even though technically they wouldn't seem to. Two of the most famous Supreme Court opinions that talk about academic freedom came up in the affirmative action arena, the Bakke case in California, and the most significant affirmative action cases, the University of Michigan cases. In both cases, the critical opinions affirming, at least conceptually, the rights of universities to use race and other forms of identity in admissions, talked about the importance of there being freedom at the university for the educators to make their own decisions regarding the makeup of a student body or a faculty. The interesting thing is that went unchallenged. Everybody assumed that there must be a freedom there that exists, though technically, for the reasons I've described, it's incoherent to think that the University of Michigan has academic freedom rights as against the state of Michigan, for example. The book then explores, in a somewhat more detailed level, whatever we mean by academic freedom in terms of public and private universities, is it something different in kind than the freedom of speech that everybody else enjoys? And I'll end with this and take a few questions. For someone that believes in freedom of speech and has been on American campuses for 30 years, used to work as a legal, as a lawyer and consultant and member of the legal team of the AAUP, I take an unpopular position in the book. I argue that there is no real First Amendment academic freedom at all, that it is a figure of speech. It is a euphemism. It is like the phrase artistic freedom. But there is no independently unique, enforceable content that professors and students enjoy that has separate meaning and more powerful meaning than that which any other citizen would have. And I'll give you in a quick nutshell the outlines of the argument. You may or may not know how many clauses there are in the First Amendment. I think there are 7. I think the First Amendment guarantees freedom of religion, freedom from the establishment of religion, freedom to assemble, freedom of speech, freedom of press. It's been implied to also protect freedom of association. I think that's it. Oh, there's a right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So you have 7. The Supreme Court has pretty much been unwilling to give meaning to the press clause. So it's very, very difficult to find U.S. Supreme Court opinions that treat the press clause as giving reporters, as reporters, rights that are different in kind from others. A lot of reporters like to think that the press clause might give them a special right, for example, to protect the confidentiality of their sources. Not at all clear that that's true. In fact, it arguably has been rejected by the Supreme Court of the United States, and more courts are acting as if it was rejected. Now, there's a clause that's actually in the Constitution that the court has said doesn't have any real meaning, separate and independently from the speech clause. If you think academic freedom has some separate meaning, then you'd have to add that clause in as an implied clause. So you'd have to assume that it means Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech and freedom of the press and academic freedom. That's something special. So you'd have to be willing to assume that it has some content that's independent. And then you'd have to explain what that content is. So far, the efforts over the years to treat academic freedom as legally enforceable and giving to professors or students rights over and above the rights of other people have failed. And I'll leave you with one quick story. I talk about this a little bit in the book, and then I'll end. There was a battle that seemed to last 100 years. I think it lasted maybe 10, 12 years, between America's law schools and our national defense establishment. And the battle was over whether military recruiters could recruit on law school for things like the JAG Corps. And because of the Department of Defense's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, the position taken by American law schools was that the DOD discriminated against gays and lesbians, and that this violated the law school's collective values. And so there was a resolution passed among the law schools not to let the Department of Defense interview. The United States retaliated against the law schools through something called the Solomon Amendment. And the Solomon Amendment said if you receive federal money at your university, you must allow the military to recruit on campus on the same terms that you'd allow anybody else to recruit on campus. So Congress didn't say you've got to let the military recruiters on. It just said you'd give up lots of money if you didn't. Now, law schools were generally okay with this because law schools didn't get any federal money for the most part. They got a little, but they didn't get much. But if you look on this gorgeous campus that we're on today, this beautiful University of Minnesota campus, there's a lot of federal money flowing in here. Most of it's not to the law school. It's to giant science grants, that would be the principal place where much of it goes, and other departments on the campus, all of whom were told if the law school keeps its policy, you're going to lose your money. So the law school sued the United States, and the case went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. And the law schools claimed, among other things, that they had a right, a First Amendment right, to resist the military folks from coming in. The Supreme Court resoundingly rejected that theory. Law schools relied largely on a freedom of association claim. They said you can't force us to associate with people we don't want to associate with. They borrowed from cases like the very famous case involving the Boy Scouts, in which the Supreme Court had said the government can't force the Boy Scouts to take gay scoutmasters if they don't want to associate with them. But in the law school's case, the Supreme Court said, that's not what's going on here. It's not like you're being asked to do what the scouts were being asked to do. Maybe if the government said, you've got to have this person as your dean, that would be sort of like having to have somebody as your scoutmaster. But these folks just want to use the interview rooms and the bulletin boards and the email system to announce when they're going to have interviews. They just want to use the, you know, and you don't have to like them. You don't have to be nice to them. You don't have to do anything other than let them use the rooms the same way. You have to really associate with them. And you're free to let everybody know you don't like their policies. It's not like just because they come and interview, it means that you're endorsing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You're perfectly free to say this is a bad thing and put up signs as they come in and stuff like that. So the Supreme Court rejected the idea that the professors and the law schools had any rights. Well, here's the kicker. While that case was winding its way through the Supreme Court of the United States, the Yale Law School faculty was bringing its own case. And the Yale Law School case and the case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, they had a sort of race, and the Supreme Court case that was decided was adjudicated. It came out of the Third Circuit. And this law school case at Yale was still lingering. And it was in the Second Circuit, different federal circuit. So you'd think the Yale law professors would have given up. You'd think they would have realized they lost their case in the Supreme Court of the United States. But they kept it going. And the theory was, well, the Supreme Court decided the case on free speech grounds. We're not making a free speech claim. We're making an academic freedom claim. It's a different right in the First Amendment, and it gives us the right to not have to be forced to accept the military recruiters as a matter of academic freedom, distinct from what the other guys were claiming, which was that they had a traditional freedom of association or freedom of speech claim. Well, the Yale law faculty could not have been beaten more sorrowfully in the Second Circuit opinion. The Second Circuit justices were beside themselves, almost seemed to laugh in the opinion, to think that the United States Supreme Court would decide this case, and all anybody had needed to do in that prior opinion was say, oh, we switched labels. We're going to call it academic freedom instead of freedom of speech, and suddenly the case would have come out exactly differently. And the court said, surely you possess no First Amendment rights different in kind than anybody else, and on that ground rejected the claim. I argue that that doesn't mean we don't have robust protection on American campuses, public and private, for the free speech rights of students and faculty members. But it's essentially the same protections that exist for anybody else under the First Amendment, the same limitations, and the same basic doctrines. Well, I think I'll stop there. You've been very nice to listen, and I'll take a few questions if anybody has any.
I'm curious what you think, as the particularly educational institutions have started to reach their disciplinary arm out to speech that's occurring outside of what would traditionally be the educational environment. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen some of the circuit courts start to make decisions involving external speech or extramural speech outside of campuses. Can you foreshadow for us what you think, how you think the courts might continue to handle this issue?
I think generally speaking, what will happen over time is that efforts by universities and efforts by high schools to punish students or faculty for speech that doesn't involve the channels of communication within the university or within the high school, that is in the general marketplace of ideas, will fail. And generally, just as in public employment law, when the citizen speaks as a citizen on matters of public concern and it's not germane directly to the job, then the government doesn't have the same rights to control the speech as it does inside. The tricky thing at the university level is that in many of our disciplines on a campus, it's hard to make the distinction between when the speech is within the professor's discipline and an extension of that professor's professional role, and when it's totally extraneous to it. So let's take one of the interesting examples, the phenomenon of Holocaust denial. At Northwestern, there was a professor who denied the existence of the Holocaust. It seems to me, had that professor been in the history department, Northwestern would have been within its rights in saying, you'll pay some penalty for this because this is just ridiculous history. This just it doesn't meet our standards of academic integrity and professionalism within the profession of history to pretend as if the Holocaust just was a hoax and didn't take place. But this professor was an engineering professor. So he was simply expressing his anti-Semitism, his arguably his hatred, and so on, but it didn't have anything to do with engineering. If it had been a state university, if it had been the University of Illinois, I think University of Illinois would have been on dicey grounds trying to penalize one of its professors because that professor went off on a diatribe on some issue extraneous to anything connected to his role. And my instinct is the professor would have prevailed in this example where it's not in the same discipline. Now, Northwestern's not technically bound by the First Amendment. So you bring in the issue that I was talking about earlier. Is it going to import First Amendment standards and say, we'll reach the same judgment that our colleagues down the road at University of Illinois would have reached? Or is it allowed to say, one of the nice things about being a private university is we don't have to always reach the same answer. And we've just decided that no matter what your discipline is, speech so over the top and so offensive to a large number of our students, to our Jewish students particularly, that's to say the Holocaust didn't even exist, we just won't tolerate, and you take some sanction. So that's an attempt at an answer. Of course, technology also makes it increasingly difficult to know what's in the building and what's not in the building. What's on the campus is what's not on the campus. So it's a fascinating battleground. You know, there was an interesting pairing of cases in the Third Circuit, both of which involved high schools, in which different panels of the Third Circuit almost simultaneously reached opposite results. And that's just a sign of how hard the issue is, I think. It's a very tough one.
I'm sorry, I'm not a lawyer. So
that's good.
Thank you.
I'll try to answer in a way that would be totally comprehensible to anybody.
Great, thank you. I'm interested in your thoughts on kind of what's been perceived as the erosion of tenure and academic freedom. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned some other protections that exist currently in the system.
Well, I'm a defender of the institution of tenure. I think that it's at its most powerful when it is tied to academic freedom norms. And so to the extent that it is treated as an economic entitlement, and therefore it's one of the perks you get for being in the union, if you will, at a time when there's generally dissatisfaction with entitlements that seem to paralyze market forces and make it difficult for employers and give people permanent jobs, whether they're productive or not, there's not a very powerful and convincing political case for it. So it is, I think, important for university professors to emphasize the academic freedom roots of tenure. You know, it did in fact begin the AAUP and a document known as the 1940 Principles on Academic Freedom, which arose. All of that story arose in response to an attempt to retaliate against a Stanford professor who was taking positions that were embarrassing to Stanford because they were contrary to some of the views of the donors that founded Stanford and that had been strong contributors to it. And so it was the fear that a professor couldn't speak out at a great research university on his or her conscience on issues that led to the strong American tradition of academic freedom. So I hope that's not too fuzzy an answer. I think that fighting that fight when it really matters in terms of the independence of the professor is critical. I'll add one other element to it. A lot of people have written thoughtfully about the meaning of the professor's freedom. And as the last question suggested, and my response to that last question suggested, as a faculty member at a university, you may in some ways have an extraordinarily robust freedom, so robust that you're not supposed to be fired for what you say on issues of public concern. At the same time, there may be limitations on what you can say that come from the norms of one's discipline and the standards of conduct that universities are expected to hold you to. So, for example, the cases are getting to be pretty consistent that you as a university professor don't have any academic freedom or tenure right to engage in harassment in a classroom, to make people uncomfortable in the classroom based on their gender or their race, there may be all kinds of things you could say on the street or at a rally that you can't say in a classroom because the students are a captive audience and they have certain rights to, you know, their own discrimination-free environment. So anyway, hope that's somewhat responsive. Yes, ma'am?
So I think it's safe to say that the First Amendment protects everyone and everybody still, whether it be university professor or provost, you're protected under the First Amendment right. As an educator myself, I think what we have to be careful to do is make sure that we don't go over the top when we touch on a sensitive issue. You know, we can't be outlandish because we're surrounded by academia and rules and statutes to protect us. We can't depend on a legal statute to protect us sometimes and just say something outlandish. You know, sometimes because we have legal grounds, we tend to lean on it. But you can't do that. You have to make sure that you're representing everyone within the university and you're not offending anyone in the university community.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think you're exactly right. And I think that kind of that temperament, that professional temperament, and that understanding of the pluralism of the university is critical. You did make one interesting statement. You mentioned a provost, and a good argument can be made. You know, I'm now a university president. A good argument can be made that senior administrators might as well forget about it if they think they have freedom of speech. I mean, if you think by comparison, the cabinet members that work for the president of the United States, it's pretty clear that they have no First Amendment freedom. They can be fired if they just say things the president doesn't like. And although the Supreme Court has created free speech rights for government employees, including the right not to be hired or fired based on your political party, so it's said that the First Amendment prohibits patronage systems, that doesn't apply to the very senior levels of government. You're entitled, if you're a Republican president, to surround yourself with Republicans. You're entitled, if you're a Democratic president, to surround yourself with Democrats, and they have to be loyal to you. And you can make a kind of analogous argument, that's the kind of thing I do in this book all the time, that there are lots of people on a campus like the University of Minnesota with plenty of academic freedom, but probably the people in the central administration building aren't among them. And a board of trustees or the board of regents and so on can say to a president, you have plenty of free speech rights, but you don't have any right to be the president of this university. And we just don't. You work for us, and what you said was over the top, even though you probably couldn't do that to most of the at least tenured professors on the campus and even the untenured professors. But that really wasn't your point. I just picked up that one phrase you used. The point, which is a great one, is that learning to exercise this right with respect for other people and their human dignity is enormously important. It's a hard lesson for a lot of our students to absorb because they don't seem to see that in society very much, and so they think that's their mandate is to engage in name-calling and exaggeration and personal attacks and not the kinds of civil discourse we hope for. You can't blame them. Because they don't get many positive role models of that. Well, listen, thank you all for coming out. It's been a pleasure to be with you. And I'm looking forward to spending the rest of the time today on the campus here with you all. Take care. Thanks.